Hello, my name is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I'm Sean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro-contagion and pro-John Lithgow podcast, where we stick to the list for better or worse. This week, we are in a very strange space. There are a couple of movies before that we've done similar, but not in tone. Perhaps similar in structure. We are discussing the 2011 film Take Shelter, which I'm going to draw a couple of connections to Next, that we also covered, I believe. Not Next.
Knowing.
Knowing. Very similar
Next,
in terms
Next is
of
the
plot,
one where
but the
Nicolas
structure
Cage.
And the tone is different.
Next is the one where Nicolas Cage can see, like, 10 minutes into the
future, or ten seconds
in the future, or whatever it is.
I always got confused with those. Well, beyond any of that confusion, first we're going to talk about what we've seen within the week. Lawson, why don't you start us off?
Sure. I have two films that I saw this week. The first of them is Red State. It is a satirical thriller directed by Kevin Smith. It follows a group of idiot teenagers. Travis, played by Michael Angarano, Billy Ray, played by Nicholas Braun, and Jared, played by Kyle Gulner. They go to have a foursome with a woman from Craigslist, played by Melissa Leo. But when they get there, they find that it's a trap that has been set by an insane, bigoted church cult led by Pastor Aben Cooper, played by Michael Parks. Happenstance leads to the police being alerted, and alcohol, tobacco, and firearm agents, led by Joe Keenan, played by John Goodman, surrounding the building in a standoff. This has its teeth around a really interesting concept, but I don't think it has a great grip. I really enjoy the social commentary that it's got going on. I think that Smith is really taking the opportunity to talk about bigotry and extremism, and he doesn't blunt it with comedy. He makes it very in-your-face and matter-of-fact in the way that these villains, because they are villains, go about what they do and the beliefs that they profess. Cooper is just a phenomenal bad guy. It's a mix of really strong characterization on Smith's part, but also Michael Parks. He is giving a really just a spectacular show-stopping, scene-chewing performance here that really is the movie. It's the thing that fuels it. It's the thing that makes it stand out. And the concept's good. And the way that they keep reshaping the concept as the movie continues, the movie keeps morphing into something a little bit new. And that stuff's pretty interesting as well. The ATF agent stuff is where I kind of hesitate for a bit. I think it might be where Smith has bitten off more than he can chew. It's ironic because it's actually some of my favorite stuff in the movie. I just am not sure whether it's just one element too many for him to keep in the air. It makes for a great finale. Goodman is excellent as this. It's actually kind of an against type role for him. But it's got a bit of a confused bit of messaging to it. It's sort of drawing an equivalency between the cult that's, you know, murdering teenagers because they think that they're sinners and government agencies, which I don't think is that well drawn out. I mean, it's taking the whole idea of Waco, which obviously massive, massive failures on the part of the ATF that led to the unnecessary death of, you know, so many people, including many, many children. But
well, it's not just that one. There are several other raids like that that have not gone swimmingly.
No.
And have been massive mistakes on the part of the ADF.
And that's fine to explore. You know, that's a decent thing to burrow into and to see what you can say about that in film. But to make them morally equivalent to literally a group of, you know, murderers, like the whole agency, I mean, and to make that the thematic point when you've just spent the first half of your movie setting up these racist, homophobic, misogynistic, you know, every bigotry under the sun, and they're literally killing anyone who doesn't subscribe to their bigotry. Like, they've made it the most, like, extreme version of that whatsoever, that to then draw a moral equivalence is...
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And, I mean, it doesn't all hold together. You can see what Smith is doing. He's mixing Waco with the Westboro Baptist Church,
yeah.
But it doesn't really hold together because he's trying to make the dichotomy a little too simple, I think. It's all combined with a sense of nastiness and nihilism that I appreciated a lot of the time, but then every now and again, Smith would just put a step too far and it would just leave me feeling like it was, he crossed a line somewhere, not a line in terms of like offense or anything, but in just a line in terms of tone. And it left me even more a little unsure thematically of, you know, his intent. And I think back to a movie like Dogma, which I had a much more consistent reaction to. I really, really liked Dogma. Although even there, I think there were some Smithisms that prevented me from signing off on that as full-throatedly as I might want to. Like, the giant monster made of shit is unnecessary in what is an otherwise quite intelligent film.
There are lines of uncouthness you can't walk past.
Yeah, but just like, it's there are a certain sort of like personal, what seemed to me to be sort of, you know, personal appeals, things that appeal to Smith, that he will throw in even if it doesn't necessarily fit the tone of the movie he's been telling up to that point. It's very cannily put together. It was a very low budget film. It was scrappily made. He actually, there's this fairly infamous episode at Sundance where Smith had made this film and he said that he was going to have like a live auction with all of the studios after the screening. The premiere screening at Sundance, and instead he came on afterwards and basically did a half-hour lecture as to how they're basically ruining the film industry, and then sold the movie to himself for like $10 or something and took it out on his own. It's quite interesting, actually. They have the entire thing on the Blu-ray as a special feature. He's really pulling it together with, you know, the resources available to him. It's got a kind of can-do attitude, which I appreciated.
And the ending's quite good, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that ending.
It's a great sort of subversion of expectations and things.
It's like, it's a bitter ending.
Although he had an ending that he wanted to do, apparently, that was going to cost too much money. And that did actually, I think it was an ending that I prefer. I'll do what I have done before, since we don't do editing anymore. I'll text you what it was.
I think I'm familiar.
I'm not. I know the actual ending, not the original intent.
It's pretty good.
Like, that is good.
Yeah, and apparently it good. Was meant to be brutal too.
Yeah.
That is good actually, but
it would have.
Part of me wants to see that.
Yeah, it would have even further run up against the tonal inconsistencies of the movie that came before it. But
like, the actual ending is kind of perfect tonally as well.
Yeah, and it works on the back of John Goodman, I think. Like, he sells that. But really, an excellent cast through and through. I mean, Goodman is good. But really, Parks just blows everyone out of the water. He's so fantastic. It does also have Melissa Leo in it. I mean, Smith kind of lucked into hiring Melissa Leo a little bit before she got the role in The Fighter, which she won the Oscar for. So because it was an independent movie and he was doing his own distribution, he actually filmed the movie before she won the Oscar, and the movie came out after she won the Oscar. So he kind of lucked out. I think given her increased profile by the time the movie came out, it's kind of a waste of Melissa Leo, though. But hey, what are you going to do? Second and lastly, in terms of film this week, I saw 50-50. It's a dramedy directed by Jonathan Levine. It follows a 27-year-old man named Adam, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who discovers that he has cancer and he has a 50-50 chance of survival. And he tries to work through that with his best friend Kyle, played by Seth Rogen, his flaky girlfriend Rachel, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, and the trainee therapist assigned to him at the hospital, Catherine, played by Anna Kendrick. This is a very sweet but very commercial version of that premise. It is inspired by the real experience of screenwriter Will Reiser, who was a friend of Seth Rogen's, and basically Seth Rogen played the same role in his real life story that he does in this movie. And this is his only screenwriting credit, and it's pretty good given that. The most impactful stuff is all of the details to do with the diagnosis, the treatment, the sort of surreality of Adam being the person that's sick, but everyone around him, all his friends and family, being the ones that actually he feels the need to comfort them because they're not handling it. The emotional complexity of it all is quite well performed, and it is at its best, I would argue, when it's going to some darker places in terms of emotion and, you know, despair amongst the characters. And it just doesn't do that as often or as full-throatedly as I'd have liked. It definitely softballs it. That's fine. That's the movie's tone. They were making this movie so that it could be released in thousands of theaters, and the people that normally go and see a Judd Apatow comedy, say, might go and see this one as well. But it does avoid the sharper edges of what that premise suggests, I think. And when it comes close to those sharper edges, mainly thanks to just fantastic performance by Gordon-Levitt, you see what could have been, and you really see how toothless it's ended up being. It sketches out the supporting characters quite well. They all have dimension to them. They all react to the situation in ways that are complex and understandable, and they all come from their own specific point of view that affects how that they're dealing with what's going on, which is appreciative. I could have done more with Kendrick. I think that she brought a really valuable dimension to the story that wasn't fleshed out enough. And I could have done also with some more from these old guys who were Adam hangs out with because they're all getting chemotherapy together. And he's the youngest person there by far. And there's these two other guys played by Matt Frewer and Philip Baker Hall, who I could have done with a lot more with because I thought that was a really interesting dynamic. These two older men and this young guy who's, you know, still got his whole life ahead of him but has this diagnosis. The handling of the Rachel character, the flaky girlfriend, is interesting because I think that that character has real dimension and has some real levels of personality and levels of complexity to her. But I kept wondering while watching the movie whether that was intentional or not, whether that happened by accident thanks to the way that Bryce Dallas Howard is playing the role, and perhaps also, you know, a kind of like 2023 goggles that I have on as I watched the story, that I felt like it might have, that I felt that the story had more sympathy for her than I am sure the writer intended. I don't know. Like, that's the thing. He may very well have intended this. He may very well not. If he did intend there to be that amount of sympathy for the character, then certainly it's not sympathy shared by any other character in the story. So it's kind of an interesting moment. But it's very well performed. As I said, Gordon-Levitt is fantastic. I would say it's worth a watch if it sounds interesting to you. It's available for streaming in Australia on Netflix, if anybody is interested. Now, do you guys have any movies to talk about?
No. We've had quite a busy week with other things, some continuing television shows, some things we wrapped up in the interim, but nothing new on the TV or movie space.
So when you said last week that you were going to get to Gerald's Game, you were lying to our audience.
I wasn't lying. I was wrong. There's a difference.
Well, we all have a pith take that we share, and Harley and I also have a separate one each besides. But there's one pith take that we all share because we all went out to the actual theatre together and saw a stage play, a new version of Frankenstein, which is a science fiction horror play adapted by Nell Lee from Mary Shelley's 1818 novel of the same name. It is newly adapted. It is not the same version as any of the other stage versions of Frankenstein that you may have seen before. But it follows Victor Frankenstein, played by D'Arcy Brown, who is really, really obsessed with reanimating the dead. He does so, and the creature that results out of that, played by Jeremiah Ray, doesn't like it. And Victor ends up not liking it either once the creature starts going about causing trouble. So before I do my thing, why don't you each talk a little bit about what you thought of it?
Yep. So, John, you want to go first?
Okay. I did enjoy this quite a bit. I'm a massive fan of the original Shelley book, and I know the story inside and out. So it was interesting seeing characters show up here that don't really show up in other adaptations, like Henry Clerval, which is Victor's best friend. So I was intrigued by the fact that he was there, and they stick fairly close to the story. They shorten parts that need to be shortened for the length that the show is. And they do take the monster seriously. They take the creature seriously, and he is a character who you feel bad for, but you are also terrified of. The staging, however, I think is the major thing about this particular show. There's a moment where the front of a ship is coming towards the audience with someone standing on it, and that blew me away. Just the fact that everyone in those front view rows, which we were in, sort of tensed up a little bit as it was coming closer and closer to the front of the stage. But yeah, the staging of this was the most incredible thing about it, as well as the performance of the creature. I quite enjoyed this.
Yep, so I'll go next. I'm a massive fan of the original book. I've listened to an audiobook of it, as well as read it quite a while back. I've seen a shitload of adaptations, not as many as John had to, for his particular reasons why. But I am quite familiar with the story in and of itself, and I'm very familiar with the genre of gothic fiction, particularly Victorian-era English gothic fiction. And this is a wonderful adaptation of that. They keep in the character of Henry Clerval. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, because he's a very important figure. As sort of a connection to the outside world for Victor. What the play, however, struggles with is it's short. Which is, you know, it has to be. You can't have them going on for, you know, dozens of hours. But it feels like scenes themselves are very, very short. That is where a lot of the abridgment comes in. Not in plot points. It's got all of the necessary plot points, but the scenes themselves are quite short. And it looks like they've shortened the time span of the story itself in that. Or at least that's what it felt like to me. Like John said, the staging is wonderful. They have these what look like LED screens that come down. They serve as sort of like video screens to show us pre-recorded stuff, give us backdrops and stuff like that. They also have this rotating thing in the middle of the stage that really helps create a sense of movement. Because there are a couple of walk and talk moments where people are just walking on this treadmill-esque thing, and it really gives it a sort of verve and life that two people standing around wouldn't have. I have to give a lot of credit to the actor playing the creature. He does a wonderful job with the physicality. He does a wonderful job with the voice. And even when the creature becomes eloquent, he still needs to get caught on things. Because while he is incredibly intelligent, while he's a very quick learner, he still was just born very recently. So he's going to struggle with some things. While the rest of the cast was really strong, I have to give major props to him, because holy shit, that dude is strong. He has several physical feats that he performs here that, while assisted by the other performers, a lot of other people simply wouldn't have been able to pull off, I think, because not only would it require the strength to begin with, but the core strength and balance. Like, he the creature holds Victor by the neck, almost over the edge of the stage. And that requires a hell of a lot of strength from both him and the performer playing Victor. And they did a really good job with that. There's a lot of wearing multiple hats here. Small cast, playing multiple characters. So there's a lot of quick changes. And quick changes are really, really difficult. And they don't do any of these in view. And they all do it off stage. And it's all really, really well done. Very quick, very snappy, very professionally done. Although, near the top of the show, I could hear someone drop something. Because you could hear a mic feed. Hear mic feedback during one of the quick changes. It is the first show of the run, though.
I don't think it was.
No? Jorn mentioned it to me afterwards.
It started on the 14th of October.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, you know, shit like that happens in live theater. You do what you can. A couple of people spoke over each other. That's one thing I noticed, too. But yeah, just really, really well done. Music. Musical accompaniment. Please, theater makers, do that more often. It helps give a lot of atmosphere to a piece, even though it was a little overbearing at the beginning while they were getting their levels ready. Overall, I had a really, really great time with this. The practical effects, the way they introduced all of the elements or bridged things that really needed abridgment, particularly the bit in Scotland. No, they hit every point I wanted them to hit. I think it was a little too short. But yeah.
And really, the Turkish really place we went to before for dinner was also quite good.
Thumbs up for them too.
This is a strong, atmospheric, very well done production. It's very professional. It's got a lot of interesting stage ideas. You've referred to some of them already. They also have these sort of video screens that they move around on stage or descend from the rafters to sort of provide, you know, additional images. They provide like foliage if you're supposed to be in a forest. But then sometimes in these really dark psychological sequences, you'll also see like close-ups of people's faces projected onto them. So there's a lot of interesting stuff they do there. There's some narration that is quite interesting in the way that it is staged to create a montage, essentially, which is difficult to do in live theatre, but they manage it. They use that in conjunction with the screens in the background and stuff like that to really sell that as a concept. The story's told well. I liked how much it embraced the horror of it, the existential horror of it also, not just for Frankenstein, but also for the creature. I think it could have used a lot more regarding the creature's sort of alienation from the world, Frankenstein's initial guilt before he actually meets the creature, but after he's created it, I think could have used a little more elucidating on, because there's something that happens that is Frankenstein realizes suddenly, oh no, the creature's coming after me. But really, I'm not sure why he immediately jumps to that conclusion, given the way that the story is structured. I don't think that they've spent enough time there. I agree with you, Harley. It could have been longer. It is just a 1 hour and 40 minute play. There was no intermission. I do think they could have added an intermission and gotten it to 2.5 hours or around there. It would have been the better for it. But it makes some really strong choices. There's one scene that stood out to me as one of the most striking, which is just the creature learning to walk for the first time after coming to.
And what we could see of it.
Yeah. And we were quite close in the front row, so when he was close to the ground, we couldn't see that much. But on that like treadmill sort of rotating circular part of the stage, you know, he's sort of stumbling around, but he's also like in distress as well. It's not just him learning to walk. It's him learning to walk whilst in pain, whilst coping with the overwhelming trauma of his own existence.
And whilst sort of learning that walking is a thing.
Yeah. And that is very well done. There's lots of atmosphere. They were definitely giving the fog machine a run for its money, perhaps overly so. But
there was a woman in front of us with a fan,
And she was going almost the entire show.
She wasn't happy because she did not like all of that fog, but she's also quite small. And if we were having problems as relatively tall people, she was having much more problems in the row in front of us, the very front row, because she couldn't see a damn thing a lot of the times. She did not seem to be enjoying it. But there's also some great pyrotechnics. They do these lightning effects. It has a lot of atmosphere to it. The dialogue of this new version can sometimes be very, very clumsy. Yeah. It's at its best when it appears to be taking stuff directly from the book. But other times, like the way that this whole thing handles the very happy poor family that live in the woods that Frankenstein eavesdrops on for months and months and months, and they're just like this, they're in an advertisement for like hot chocolate or something. Like,
yeah.
They've wandered out of...
That's not completely wrong to how they are in the book.
No, but in the book, they make a little bit more sense.
You learn
more about
it. But in
this version, it's like a Folgers ad.
They've abridged that shit.
But it's like, just like...
The only thing about it that isn't a Folgers ad is that the siblings don't want to have sex.
See, you referenced that with the assumption that absolutely everyone who listens to this podcast will understand.
There's a Folgers ad.
We all know the Folgers ad, but...
I'm explaining it for the audience. Look it up. Always, it's a Folgers ad.
Pop culture references always work so well when you have to explain them.
There's a Folgers ad where the two actors playing a brother and a sister have so much chemistry that it seems like they want to claw each other's clothes off.
Yeah, and, like, he's not lying. Like, it's extreme.
It's palpable.
It's like, there is a website, I can't remember if it was Vice or The Ringer, it was one of those types of websites, have done an oral history on that particular ad, because it did become kind of an internet phenomenon. Like, it's not just Sean that's come to this conclusion.
There's a bunch of parodies and everything.
Mm.
It's legit.
Was SNL did something, didn't they, at one point? I don't know. But
I think so.
Anyways, those poor people in the forest, it is a little bit like, oh, isn't it so great that we all have each other and we get along so well and, you know.
I'm going to read to you this portion of Paradise Lost, but we're all going to be happy about it.
Yeah, it didn't work as well as I think they wanted it to.
I was smiling when that moment happened because I was like, this isn't a happy story. Paradise Lost is not happy. This isn't the kind of thing you read to your blind father.
But it's very well performed. Brown and Ray are very strong as Frankenstein and the creature, respectively. And they get a lot of good use out of a talented minimal cast that they swap in and out into different roles as the story calls for it. It's not that very many people in terms of the actors. And they're used well. And I'll agree with you, Harley. I appreciated the incidental music. I think it was well used. I think it added to the atmosphere. And especially in the final scene, I think it was used to great effect. I do have another piss take, and I know Harley does as well. But seeing as I'm already mid-flow, I'll go first. It is another book. The Night is for Hunting, the sixth and penultimate installment in the Tomorrow series of young adult thriller novels by John Marsden. Of course, this being the series about, kids in Australia coming back from camping trip to realize they've been invaded and then having to survive, essentially. What does any long-running series do eventually? It chucks in a precocious child to keep things interesting. And
the Scrappy-Doo effect.
Yeah, and that is what they've done here. Ellie and co. find themselves the guardians of five recalcitrant children. And when I say children, I mean the oldest is 10, that have been on their own, sort of surviving as feral kids since the beginning of the war.
And so it's some Mad Max Thunderdome shit.
Yeah, and that's kind of it. That's the story. They're playing Babysitter's Club with these five children. And it's the best book of the series since the second one. Like, it really, really works. From what I can tell, reading about it online, it seems to be a bit of a divisive installment. There's very little action, and that has opened it up to criticism from some people who are in it for the guerrilla raids and things. But I really appreciated that it took this opportunity to slow down and to approach things from a different point of view, a different dynamic. It's very much about these little kids and the way that their presence affects the group dynamics.
It's a different part of growing up.
Yeah, and it offers an interesting parallel to the main group, that they've become, you know, very hardened and they've seen a lot. But so two of these kids who are so much younger than them, and it sort of keeps playing on Marsden's core themes of lost childhood. And it uses that to compare and contrast. It offers further ways to explore the people that our main characters have become as the series has gone on. The little kids are well written and mostly, I find, quite likable. Marsden doesn't go easy on them either because they're children. He is just as ruthless in the way that he tells his plot and the ways he sets up his character psychology as he would otherwise have been. For me, it's the action that's become the dull part, and it has been the dull part since the third book, frankly, with the attack on the harbour. How many more food raids can they go on that unexpectedly go wrong? How many more chases through the bush can they survive and then get away from by the skin of their teeth? I mean, at this point, I'm over 40 hours into this series in audiobook terms, and there's been a lot of those, and it's just not that many ways to do variations on that theme anymore. But it is building momentum now, which is odd, actually, considering the slow pacing of this particular story. But you can't pull this trick too early, the trick with the kids, I don't think. It is a trick that you're only allowed as you're approaching the end, as you're building up stakes for the finale. It's setting those terms that final book is going to take place on, and it's a lot more character focused, a lot more interpersonal interaction. It really is drilling down into the way that these characters have been coping, the friction that has come up between them, the way that they are beginning to fray psychologically. Well, not beginning, they have been for a while, and it is Marsden stopping to take stock of all of that before the end. I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate how much he is emphasizing how cold and hard Ellie in particular has become, and how kind of concerned she is about that fact. In terms of talking about the trauma of war, the psychological toll of war, it is Marsden preparing his closing arguments, I think, and it leaves it in a spot that makes me very interested to see how this story ends, because I find myself more and more interested in the sequel trilogy, the Ellie Chronicles, which is set after the conclusion of the war. And I find that very interesting as an idea, perhaps more so than I did before I started this main series, because in some ways, especially in this middle to end part of the series, it can seem a little like the repetitiveness of the war narrative has started to get in the way of some of Marsden's bigger interests in terms of his conversations about having to grow up really quick and the effect of war on children who survive it. And I wonder whether once this whole guerrilla narrative is removed from play in the sequel trilogy, whether he will have more themes to explore, more of a free hand to explore those themes. So I look forward to it. But I'm almost done for the main series. I go now into the last book. It is the longest book, but it's the last one. So I shall report back soon.
Yep, so I also have a book to discuss, but not a novel, a comic book, as is my oeuvre. It is titled Arkham Asylum, Living Hell. Written by Dan Slott, with art done by Ryan Sook, Wave on Graw Badger, and Jim Royal. Looking to escape a long prison term for embezzlement, the finance world's great white shark, Warren White, foolishly pleads insanity and finds himself remanded to Gotham City's Arkham Asylum for the criminally insane. Now living in a violent house of madness, with such deranged killers as the Joker, Two-Face, Killer Croc, Poison Ivy, and Mr. Freeze, this white-collar criminal's plea becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy as he embarks on his own personal journey of insanity and degeneracy as well. This is from 2003, and I picked this up a while back at a swap meet. I had heard about it as a spiritual successor to my much-loved Arkham Asylum Serious House on Serious Earth by Grant Morrison and Dave McKean, but I found this one a little more straightforward. Serious House on Serious Earth is very dense, very in its own head, with art that makes you struggle to get through. As great as the art is, it is that disinterested in accommodating you. Sook, Grawbadger, and Royal's art is much more standard and straightforward. While keeping a very gothic sensibility about itself, it is brutal at times. It is expressive. And what's most interesting here is that this is, again, not a Batman story. Batman does show up, the Joker shows up, but these aren't significant figures here. Who we follow is we follow both Warren White, the Great White Shark, as he later becomes, and Aaron Cash, who works as a security guard at Arkham Asylum, who has had a prior run-in with Killer Croc, who has bitten off and devoured his hand. So Aaron Cash has a hook for a hand. If that reminds anyone of anything, you would recall the Arkham series of games. Aaron Cash is a recurring character in that. This is very much a spiritual successor. It has a lot to say about madness. It also involves elements of the occult. And a very fascinating character that I believe was created for this, but don't quote me on it, called Doodlebug, who is a graffiti artist and visual artist who went insane and started mixing his victims' blood into the paints and stuff like that. I've always been interested in having that character adapted into a live-action thing, because I think that could be quite interesting, kind of a Evil Within 2 kind of vibe to it. Art is clean, dialogue is really good, Dan Slott's a good one for that. Other people would recognize Dan Slott from his run on Spider-Man, particularly his Superior Spider-Man stuff. But yeah, this is really great stuff. But what is most remarkable about it is how it's not exactly of a piece with other work from 2003. Because the 2000s in comics had this kind of glossy sheen about it. It's just coming out of the 90s, which was very not great, I'm gonna say, for a lot of people and a lot of characters. But the 2000s overcorrected in a lot of senses. But the story here feels a little older. It feels more of a piece with stuff on the Vertigo line, like Sandman, Swamp Thing, Animal Man. It's very interested in digging down into concept rather than, oh, putting a glossy sheen over everything Mark Millar style and being super duper edgy about everything. There is edge here, don't get me wrong, but it is rusted. And if you cut yourself on Arkham Asylum Living Hell, it will stick around in your bloodstream for quite a while. I love the use of supernatural elements here. We get a really, really fun turn from Jason Blood / Etrigan, because one cannot forget that Arkham Asylum, as established in Serious House on Serious Earth, has a great deal of supernatural baggage attached to it. The Spirit of Arkham, Amadeus Arkham, Mad Dog Hawkins, all of that sort of stuff coalesced into making the asylum itself a pretty detailed haunted house. Not only because of the madness of the people within, but also the madness of the space as it exists. That has been explored in other runs, like a lot of the Grant Morrison stuff, Battle for the Cowl, all of the Jeremiah Arkham Black Mask stuff. That would happen in like the 2010s. But yeah, I highly recommend Living Hell as a book. It's not quite the same as Serious House, but I think that gives it its own identity as a spiritual successor. Yeah, it's quite a good book. If you want to track down a hard copy of it, it's really, really difficult to find. You should be able to find decently priced copies on like Amazon or something. But I do believe that it is on the DC Universe app as a collected edition. So that's possibly the best place to find it. A lot of the older books I've got aren't exactly easy to track down, especially since runs as small and incidental as Living Hell, that shit doesn't get reprinted. So it kind of falls by the wayside, and I find that to be a real damn shame. Yeah. So that's my pith take. So does anyone else have anything? No?
Nope.
Excellent. Now we are going to play for you the trailer to Take Shelter.
You got a good life, Curtis. I think that's the best compliment you can give a man. Take a look at his life and say, that's good.
I love you.
Okay, bye.
What's the matter with you, Curtis?
It sounds like thunder.
What sounds like thunder?
I've been having these dreams. They always start with a kind of storm.
Missed you at church this morning, Curtis.
Thinking about cleaning up that storm shelter out back.
Where the hell have you been?
I know. I'm sorry. I had to run in here.
I'm going to build out the tornado shelter in my backyard. I could use some help.
The hell you want to do that for?
This needs to be done.
You didn't say one word about this to me.
I didn't want you worrying about it.
Samantha!
Are you out of your mind?
I'm doing this for us. I know you don't understand.
You want to waste money on a stupid tornado shelter?
Your mother was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia in her 30s.
I thought people were watching me and listening to me.
Gilbert's been telling me how strange Curtis has been acting lately.
Is anyone seeing this?
Tell people what you've been doing.
I know, I'm sorry.
Just how you treat friends?
Yeah, I'm fine.
That was the trailer for Take Shelter. It is a psychological drama directed by Jeff Nichols, and it follows Curtis LaForge, played by Michael Shannon, a construction worker in Middle America who believes he might be becoming mentally ill. His mother struggled with paranoid schizophrenia, which eventually saw her institutionalized. And now, as Curtis approaches the age she was when things started to get really bad, he has begun to suffer from horrifying nightmares. Every time he goes to sleep, he dreams of ominous storm clouds which open to unleash a torrent of black rain upon the world, slick and dark like motor oil. Birds fall from the sky dead, and everywhere the rain touches, his friends and neighbors turn against him, attacking him violently. When he begins to experience elements of these dreams as hallucinations while awake, Curtis becomes deeply concerned that he'll have to leave his wife Samantha, played by Jessica Chastain, and their young daughter Hannah, played by Toba Stewart, like his mother was forced to leave her family. Curtis can't bear the thought, especially given the family's financial struggles. What's more, Hannah recently lost her hearing, and now Curtis and Samantha are trying to find a way to get her a cochlear implant without completely destroying their finances. Curtis seeks therapy, but nothing seems to help. He becomes paranoid, increasingly certain that his dreams are not dreams but premonitions, a dark warning of a storm that will soon descend upon the world. Determined to protect his family, Curtis obsessively prepares for the oncoming threat, taking out a poorly financed bank loan to build a storm shelter in his backyard. Increasingly alarmed, Samantha tries to help her husband, but as Curtis's dreams grow more and more sinister, his life begins to collapse, and he becomes more and more dissociated from his family. So, before we get too deep into this, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on Take Shelter? Why don't you start us off, Sean? Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I quite enjoyed this. This has a very slow, very ponderous, very dreadful energy to it. And that comes through with the cinematography, the performances, the sort of at both times muted and also really detailed performance from specifically Michael Shannon. And the way that it just builds and builds and the storm clouds swell over this poor man, it's has a lot to say about climate change and the dread of that.
All right, you ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I didn't get a climate change allegory from it. I got a financial crisis allegory from it. What this movie was like to me, it's very tactile, right? It's very physical. Like, it's got a tangible reality to it that you could see this happening to somebody. And he doesn't automatically think that it's, you know, prophecy. He thinks it's madness. And great performances, great cinematography, great movie. Great music, especially at the end.
I like this. I think it's reserved and buttoned up. Perhaps a little too much for my taste, but it's also quite thoughtful and empathetic. I think it's anchored by some very strong performances, particularly Michael Shannon, but also Jessica Chastain. Mm. I think the beauty of it is that it can be multiple readings. It is fine. I see definitely the financial stuff baked into the DNA of the film, but it can be climate as well. It can be any number of things. What it is about a man who doesn't know if he can protect his family anymore. Mm.
I do see where you're coming from with it being very held back, and that comes through with a lot of the scenes being just from Michael Shannon's perspective.
Yeah, and it comes down to, I suppose this is as good a place to start, from what a kind of traditional example of masculinity he is.
Mm. He's a That's guy, what I was picking up. Yeah.
He's a guy who's very much the kind of walk it off kind of approach to life. He's not the type that wants to complain. He's a bit uneasy about seeing a therapist. He definitely doesn't want to admit to his wife that something might be wrong.
Yeah, to the point where the thing that makes him tell her what he's been going through is he literally has a seizure. And it's after that point that he doesn't feel like he can lie to her anymore. It's like, if he had just told the truth from the get-go, half of this shit wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
Well, and you can see that that's because of the way he was raised. Mm. His mother was suffering a severe mental illness and had to leave the family. The reason why she left the family was that she accidentally left him in a car when he was 10 years old and was found 3 weeks later eating out of the garbage bin. And
across state lines, like she'd wandered.
Across state lines, too. So it goes to show that he's all buttoned up because he was raised by what seems to be a traditionally masculine figure in his life, but also the fact that he doesn't want to do that to his family. He doesn't want to disappear.
And it's not just
but
that.
But he ends up doing so anyway.
It's the community that he comes from as well. It's his friends. It's his neighbors. It's the, you know, the line of work that he chooses to pursue.
It's middle America. He's a white guy. He's in construction. Like, and I said this to John, both Michael Shannon and his maid in this,
Shea Whigham,
they kind of just look like normal dudes.
Normal guys.
Right? They look like normal guys doing normal guy stuff.
Although, as I was watching this, I was thinking, if you are doing another version of The Shining, Michael Shannon is the pick for Jack.
I can see it.
Yeah, I can see it.
He's less outwardly crazy than Nicholson.
Because I know that's
he's
your
much
problem.
More reserved than Nicholson.
It depends on what effect you want to have, because my mind does go to Nicolas Cage. That could be pretty good.
That could be really fun.
That would be a very different version of The Shining.
It would be going in the opposite direction of Kubrick and just being outwardly hilarious.
I mean, it is too late for it now, but John Lithgow in his 40s would have been a great... Because he could have actually walked that bridge that Nicholson didn't, of actually being like a...
Oh, Nicholson didn't walk the bridge. He willfully disregarded it, and he jumped directly into the water. Well, and it was Kubrick's decision.
It's the same problem that Stephen King has with it. It's the problem I've always had with it, is that Nicholson starts the movie crazy, and he's got nowhere to go from there.
I think Kubrick did that on purpose because...
Oh, no. But that's The Shining.
Yeah.
Let's not get stuck on The Shining. What I like about Shannon's performance here is that buttoned up nature. The fact that he's terrified, not only of the dreams he's having, what it's doing to him physically when awake,
He's also terrified about telling anybody. And that being not a sign of weakness, but a sign that what happened to his mother is happening to him. He looks like the kind of guy who has spent his life terrified of it being hereditary and coming down to him.
Well, he's also the type of guy who's deeply uncomfortable expressing any kind of emotional vulnerability.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes to the way that he just can't open up to anyone. Even, like, that scene at the dining room table after when he actually does have to confess it to Jessica Chastain, this is what's going on, he can't keep it quiet anymore. It is like pulling teeth. There's something like kind of torturous and slow about the way that the movie, it won't accelerate through that. It wants you to stop and watch him have to verbalize it to her.
He's in agony.
Yeah. And that comes out of who he is, the way he was raised, the place that he lives, the work that he does, the friends that he has. And it's all coming through this. I think you're right on the money, John, in that it does obviously have it has a climate thing to it. It has a whole variety of things to it. But I think what it is not necessarily any specific thing, but it's the idea of a guy who just knows that something bad is coming and he just isn't confident that he can make a difference to protect himself and his family.
The main theme of the movie is the oncoming storm, the thing that is on its way, be that financial ruin, be that an actual disaster, or be that the oncoming of a mental illness.
Mm. And
that's the storm that is coming.
Yeah. The thing that is most explicitly expressed in the movie itself is what Harley was talking about, which is the post-global financial crisis state. Because this movie does come just 3 years after that.
The moment I got into it, I was like, oh yeah, that's the kind of movie we've got here.
Yeah.
Post-financial crisis film. I remember it well.
But also consider like the work that it appears to be a single-income household. I mean, Samantha sells these little trinkets and stuff that she makes on the weekends at the market. You get that scene that has, you know, no other cause to be in the movie except to show you their financial straits, where this woman like seriously lowballs the price that she is willing to pay for it. And Samantha,
that's not proper haggling.
Yeah. And Samantha is going to let her walk away, but then she can't. She's got to sort of just accept this lowball figure because they need the money.
Mm.
And it's like, that woman watching that just pissed me off.
But it's construction. The housing market was decimated by the 2008 collapse.
There's the fact, like, he goes to get a loan. They talk about money quite often here.
Yeah, constantly.
And they have the medical bills for their daughter.
They have the additional stress of America's dystopic healthcare system, although that's something of a paradoxical name, healthcare, for what they've got going on over there.
And if you want more information about that stuff, there's a fantastic video by Brian David Gilbert where he goes through
all of the associated language.
All of the acronyms, all of the honestly Kafka-esque bullshit that you have to go through. Watch that video or just go and live in America. I suggest watching the video.
You'll get that reality soon enough. When I watched that video, most of his videos, really funny. That video, dread drips off every bit of it. But yeah, then there's the fact that, you know, throughout the movie, they're talking about his medical insurance.
Yeah.
And how that's going to carry the family through. There's the scene where he goes to get... Yeah, there's the scene where he goes to get his medication. And it's like, what? $40.75 or something like that. And he's like,
copay after insurance, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, what about off the copay? Then he's like, that is off the copay.
And it's like a incredibly mild sedative. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
Jesus.
An absolute nightmare.
And that's American $47 or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
So that's closer to 100 AUD.
Yeah. Well, 2011, it was still a lot more.
Yeah. But even like just the exchange rate,
yeah,
it would still be close to 100. I mean, the interest rates obviously nowadays you'd probably be looking at, you know, something close to 150, 160 Australian dollars. It's not a good system. Let's just leave it at that.
Bad system.
But it's all tied up in that. You do get the impression that, you know, they might have lived a fairly comfortable life prior to whatever happened with the daughter, prior to the global financial crisis, because that's the thing. The daughter is not born deaf. This is something that's happened recently. They have a conversation
acquired
at the
disability.
Beginning. They have the conversation at the beginning of the film about how they he still takes his shoes off when he comes home late so he doesn't have to wake her up, but he doesn't need to anymore because she's deaf. Like that. So clearly this is something that's happened recently. But you get the impression that before that they were solidly middle class. Now they are not anymore. They're
in a much more precarious situation.
Much more precarious situation. They're really having trouble making ends meet, which situates this, especially in its setting of this small town in what appears to be, you know, this sort of middle America, what they would call a flyover state. It's a sort of pejorative term that it's a state that you fly over as you go from one state to another state with something worth doing in it. That's the, you know, the coastal elite kind of, you know, terminology there.
It's a quiet
there.
Place. Yeah. It's a quiet area.
But this is like textbook location for ground zero of the fallout of the GFC.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, his solution to his terror at this oncoming storm is to do up the storm shelter. They have a storm shelter already, but he feels this immense urge to extend it. So he buys a shipping container, he hires a lot of equipment, he takes some equipment from work. Credit to Robert Longstreet as the boss in that part of the storyline. I like the scene where he's talking to his boss after boss found out that, you know, he's been using the diggers and stuff. And how he's like, he doesn't want to sack him.
See, this is the thing. I actually think there's another solution here that was fine, was just put him on unpaid leave for 6 weeks until his daughter gets the medical thing and then sack him. Like,
yeah.
There's a way to just be like, I know you're going through a tough time. I still got to fire you, but I'm going to help your daughter get the cochlear implant.
Yeah. But like, I like how the guy's like, I'm not pissed that you did it. I'm pissed that the liability of you going on the roads with this, coming here to a place that's not a work site with work equipment. You could have got hurt. Someone on the road could have gotten hurt. You could have damaged something. That would have been the company that had to respond to that. The insurance alone does not cover outside work for equipment like that. And it all comes to down to those kinds of stresses, especially since Curtis can't help himself. He needs to do something to alleviate the terror. But the terror stays, and it sticks to him like oil. And every time he wakes up, he's terrified of something. He gets bitten by the dog in his first nightmare, and he has to put the dog out the back. He can't have it in the house anymore because he can't stand to look at it.
His friend attacks him in the second nightmare, or in another nightmare, and then he's got to try and get his friend reassigned off of his crew at work because he can't be around him anymore.
But he can't look him in the eye anymore. And eventually his wife attacks him in a nightmare, and he flinches away from her. And one of the things that really got to me is one of the moments when he wakes up, I believe it's from the second nightmare, he wakes up, and you could tell that he's screaming, right? But there's no sound coming out. You could see in his body language that that's sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
Occurring to him.
It was that moment where I started really thinking of The Shining and him being in that. Because that looked like the editing from The Shining.
But what I'm saying is, like, the fact that I think he's doing such a great job. Shannon is doing such a great job here. Because it's both what he's doing and what he's not doing, right? It's what he does and what he holds back. Because you can see that this guy, he's not a violent person. In fact, he doesn't like confrontation of any sort. You can see it in his body language. But the moment that he sees his friend turn on him, he loses it. And he loses it publicly. And a funny story about that sequence, I saw in the trivia, they hired extras for the sequence. They knew a movie was being shot, but they were like, hey, it's just the scene where all you guys are going to have some dinner. And you're all just going to be having a nice meal,
and they're going to be like a couple of quiet conversations. They didn't know someone was going to lose their shit. They didn't know there was going to be a physical altercation.
I will say that for me, that's the dialogue of that scene is a little too far. Where it's like, there's a storm coming, and when it gets here, there's going to be nothing left. Like, the fact that he goes so full on, don't go up to Camp Crystal Lake, you know.
Real Harbinger.
You're going to die.
It's a little too much for what has been up to this point, and will continue to be a fairly withdrawn movie. And, like, look, you get, like, that he's got this sort of obsessive-compulsive thing that he's doing. He's renovating the storm shelter. He's got this feeling of dread that he can't escape, even though he knows that the logic isn't there to back it up. But for him to just go fully, like, given how much he's resisting actually verbalizing that as something he believes or embracing that as a logical outcome of these dreams that he's having, the fact that he then just sort of starts proselytizing to all of these people about doomsday.
Well,
is
part
too
of it, I think.
Me.
I think he was throughout most of the movie, he was balancing between the two options. Part of him wants it to be the mental illness. Part of him deeply wants that because if his dreams come true, that's terrifying. Not just for him, but for the world. And the other part of him is like, yeah, but I don't want to be sick. I want to be with my family. I don't want to be taken away. And I believe that that scene is the straw that breaks the camel's back. Yes, it is a lot. But I do like the bit at the end of that scene where he kind of breaks down in front of his wife.
Mm.
And there's something so honest and raw about that vulnerability there.
Not only that, breaking down in front of everyone.
Yeah. Like, he's not okay. He seemed to be comfortable with the counselor that he had until, you know...
until he had to sit down and explain everything again to a different person.
Well, someone who seemed to be less interested in listening as well. You know, and that's one of the parts of it, too. It just feels very real in that regard, you know?
Let's talk a little bit about the climate change part of
yes.
it.
Yes.
Because you brought it up, Sean, and I do think you're right that it's there. I do think it's intentional, too. I do think it is something that Nichols was thinking about. Whether he, you know, intended it to be the main thrust of things or not, he definitely, I think, intentionally laced through stuff to make you think of it. Specifically the black rain, the oily rain, and the birds dying. That is... obviously, it's a different kind of doom, a different kind of, like, existential threat to life and limb than the, you know, financial element of it is. But it is, again, this big thing that's beyond his control. You know, it's this anxiety that's on the horizon. It's this thing that has the potential to do an incredible amount of harm to his family, his way of life. His ability to live his life the way that he wants it to. And he is powerless to respond to that. He's powerless to do anything to stop it. It's beyond him. It is something that will either happen or it will not, or it will affect him or it will not. And there's not a damn thing that he can do that can change the trajectory of that in any way.
All he can do is prepare for the worst.
Yeah. And that is, I think, you know, that's the common thread between that and the financial angle is that it is completely beyond his control. And this is the thing that rankles him the most, that gives him the most anxiety, is that this is a guy, you know, this is a traditionally masculine guy, a man's man, who is used to being in control of his own destiny, is used to being in control of his own life. And there's a fragility to his own happiness and his own prosperity that he is seeing now and can't unsee.
One of the bits that I love... it's a scene of, like, it's a moment, fragment of a scene with real vulnerability, is when his brother comes over to check up on him because Curtis's wife has asked him to come over and check up on him. And there's the moment where Curtis pulls his brother in for a hug, and you can tell that that's not something that they do. They're not close in that regard. They don't seem very close, really, at all. They seem close as, you know, brothers.
Two men in that specific
two men in that
culture.
Specific area and specific economic area can be. And that little moment of vulnerability where his brother hugs him back is really, really showing to how scared Curtis is. That he wants some sort of comfort in that. And he reaches out to his big brother for that.
So, John, you're the one that brought up the environment thing, the climate change thing. What's your perspective on that? Why do you think that that was your immediate read of it?
Well, because it was around that specific time period where it really became a solid thing that people were concerned about. And it has this sense of a thing that is coming, a beast lurching towards Bethlehem, which will not stop, a fated thing. And that ties in with the financial inequality, the issues with the healthcare, the issues with his burgeoning mental illness. But it's hard not to have that kind of reading of an oncoming natural disaster. There are shades of fear here about something like Hurricane Katrina, or floods, or tornadoes, and things like that. And those kinds of weather events are going to happen more and more as climate change ramps up, as the issues are not solved. The fact that it's raining oil, that it looks like it's raining oil, is huge to that, because that is a literal change in the climate. That is a thing that shouldn't happen. The birds start dying. The natural world itself starts having an issue. And the way that he's looked at by the people in his life is that he is insane. That he's this Cassandra on top of the hill. And in that moment where they all hear where there's a storm, they all run into the shelter, it has this feeling of, oh shit, it's happened. The big thing that was headed this way has happened. But when they leave it...
And tell me if you disagree with this or not. He wants it to have happened, I think.
Yeah.
He needs it in his own self. He needs that to be the case. And he doesn't want it to be the case. He needs it to be.
And it isn't just that he'd be proven right. It's that finally, it's not...
He knows...
Incoming, it is. There's a catharsis there. The sword of Damocles is no longer hanging. It's dropped. Or we can...
Exactly.
And...
Well, it's also proof that he's not ill.
Yeah.
Which is what he's terrified of as well. And yeah, there's just most scenes have this dread coming on. Like the scene with where he's buying the gas masks. And I was like, well, they bring up the money again. $175 for the cheapest gas mask. It's not something you want to cheap out on, that's for damn sure.
They don't have any kid sizes in stock. The kids have got to have a special hood or something. He seems to decide, she'll probably be fine, because he doesn't pursue that any further.
Well, he's got the oxygen for her. But yeah, it's just every single anxiety he ends up having gets wrapped up in how much it's going to cost to assuage that fear.
And that ties in, again, to a lot of the climate change things and people being scared but not knowing what to do and not wanting, and there being that fear around how much is it going to cost to go green, both on a personal level and on a more societal governmental level as well.
Let's talk a little bit about the...
Well, just one more thing I wanted to say on the climate crisis approach is that this is an example of pre-apocalyptic fiction.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's what the ending of the movie would suggest. And I think that that's very, very, very interesting. Because there are a couple of other pre-apocalyptic pieces of fiction. And in the modern day, climate change is the big one. Is the big looming apocalypse. There are several other apocalypses that are also on the table. But climate change is kind of the unavoidable one at this point. And it's very interesting to see that reading. Because at that point, 2011, people were taking it seriously before then, but the 2010s is when civilians, started to take it very seriously.
See, I don't know. I mean, I feel almost like it was less of a political football in the 2000s than it was in the 2010s.
Mm.
Because I feel like something happened somewhere along the line. I don't know. I just remember a real pivot in public sentiment where people really did splinter off somewhere around the 2009-2010 era into denialism.
Well, Lawson, it's when the Republicans remembered that they have stake in oil companies.
But it wasn't just in America, it was here as well.
Yes, I was being facetious, but it has become a political issue.
Yeah.
Climate change. Shouldn't be. You know, we all live on the same planet after all, but, you know, there you have it.
Let's talk a bit about those visions, those dreams. I think that this movie is actually sort of tailor-made for mainstream kind of Oscar-y success in all but one way, and that way is the nightmares. Because I think that, you know, I just imagine you telling an Academy voter, oh, it's about global financial crisis and it's about, you know, middle America's response to it. And they're like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah,
they're
yeah.
They're salivating.
And there's some really sad people in it and they're dealing with a lot of hard stuff and there's going to be some crying, there's going to be some yelling. It's like, oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
I love your interpretation of these people like, this kind of misery porn gives them the horn.
Look at the kind of stuff they tend to give
trophies
to, though. I feel like they're right there for it, right up until you get to the Black Rain and the apocalyptic visions. That's when it turns into this sort of, like, pseudo-genre part that makes it just that.
That's when they say, but you can't make it actually scary.
Well,
we're just little guys.
Not very scary, but like it's the difference between them making a story about a man struggling with his finances and his mental illnesses in post GFC America, versus the movie that they've actually made in terms of like this weird, like Cassandra-esque thing running through it. That's way more interesting.
They probably weren't very happy that it turned out to be true.
Yeah. The stuff that the version that they have made is way more interesting to me than than that other version. But
yeah, absolutely.
It is the kind of thing that I think in the minds of some of the, let's say, tastemakers, if you want to use that sort of elitist term, would mark this as a less serious film because it has chosen to go in this direction.
I agree.
Which is changing. It has changed a lot over the last 5 years or so. The fact that Parasite won Best Picture, but especially the fact that Everything Everywhere All at Once won Best Picture.
Which is all of the genres.
Yeah.
Like, that's a movie with a butt plug fight. That's shades of difference.
I don't know. Maybe someone gave them their cocaine back. I don't know, but
this is the cycle.
I'm getting at.
This is the cycle in the Oscars where they gave it to the artist. Anyone remember, like, anyone really wearing out the Blu-ray of The Artist, you know?
I've seen it once, and I remember being bored out of my mind until the end.
It's because it made all of the choices that designate it as an awards film, you know?
Yeah.
In the end, whether it was the best film of the year didn't really matter. It selected all of the trappings that it needed to.
Mm. It's a science at this point.
I always do think, I mean, it is rare that the best film of the year, or the best film, like, best film of the year is always going to be subjective. Like, my favorite movie of last year was The Menu. The Menu was never going to win Best Picture. I know that. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, a rigged system. But let's just say that, in my opinion, the best film nominated for Best Picture rarely is the film that wins. And I think that does come down to a kind of bias. I mean, I'm looking at, like, Shape of Water also was sort of another crack in the wall, crack in that glass ceiling for Oscar weirdness, I suppose.
Well,
And genre film.
Yeah.
I think the reason why that was able to bridge the gap is that Guillermo del Toro made a fish person that every single person on the Academy wanted to bang.
I mean, that might be part of it too.
And it's like, and it's also, he's playing to that very old classic kind of horror film.
Yeah, the horror films that a lot of the Academy members
grew up on.
A lot of the people that they probably took their high school... A lot of those people probably took their high school dates to a movie starring Boris Karloff. Like, we're talking about... They're not just the upper crust because of their wealth, but because they are old.
Well, did Take Shelter earn any kind of buzz?
Yes, it was critically acclaimed. It has a 92% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It is a cult hit, and it is something that critics went to bat for. It got a lot of festival stuff, and a lot of the smaller critical groups awarded it. But I do just want to redo the list of the films nominated for Best Picture in the cycle that it would have been eligible for. Obviously, sure. As we said, The Artist won, but like this is frankly the most awards-baity lineup of awards that there could be. The Descendants, which is supposed to be pretty good. I've not seen it, but Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, which is kind of an internet punchline. The Help, Hugo, Midnight in Paris, a Woody Allen movie. Moneyball, which is supposed to be pretty good. The Tree of Life, which I see incredibly divisive things about. And War Horse, the Steven Spielberg book. Steven Spielberg movie about a horse that goes to war.
So you froze for a sec for me. What were those other ones?
What was the last one you heard?
Woody Allen one.
The other ones were Moneyball, The Tree of Life, and War Horse.
Yeah, that all tracks.
But like,
when
the least Oscar-y movie in that list is the one directed by Martin Scorsese, like that's a sign of a fairly traditional lineup.
Oh, absolutely.
Admittedly, it's like the least Martin Scorsese movie. It's this weird, adult book adaptation of this boy in this like steampunk adventure. But
but it was a movie that celebrated movies, so it's inevitably going to become one of those recursive Ouroboros the Academy like.
So, Hugo? Did you say?
Yeah.
That was Scorsese. I thought that was Zemeckis.
No, it was Scorsese.
No, Scorsese. Is Scorsese doing his best Zemeckis?
You look at those posters and you look at the movie and you tell me that doesn't scream Zemeckis.
Yeah, but it's like, it's so much more professional and well put together than anything Zemeckis has done in like 15 years. Like, sure. Zemeckis has gone the Tim Burton route. He's not maintained the quality.
Yeah.
He's drifted.
Kind of feels very Spielberg-y too.
Hugo does. I mean, Spielberg was off doing Tintin that year.
Yeah. That's
another
probably
movie
why
that
I
screams
That's probably
Bob
why
Zemeckis.
I associate those two together so much. Yeah.
But I mean, like, even looking at the rest of... I mean, this was a bad year. I don't know what was in the water this year, but it was a bad year for anything left of center. So, Best Director, The Artist, is the winner here. Michelle Hazanavicius, who I don't want to be unkind, but a man we'd never heard of before and have never heard of again. And even the other nominees. Scorsese, okay. Alexander Payne for The Descendants, okay. But then Woody Allen and Terrence Malick. Best Actor, Jean Dujardin for The Artist, won. And again, just the people you'd expect. Meryl Streep wins for The Iron Lady.
Deserved?
Yeah.
Well, you give Streep an Oscar.
Christopher Plummer wins for Beginners, for Best Supporting Actor. Octavia Spencer wins for The Help, Supporting Actress. Original Screenplay goes to Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris. Adapted Screenplay goes to the writing team for The Descendants. From the looks of it, like the most outlandish film to actually win an Oscar was Animated Feature, in which Gore Verbinski won for directing Rango. The one about Johnny Depp voicing a gecko.
Hunter S. Thompson lizard,
Yeah, Hunter S. Thompson cowboy lizard.
Hmm.
That was a weird movie.
It's an odd one. It's a really weird one.
It gave me weird vibes when I saw it for the first time.
Did they make a sequel to that one?
I don't think so.
I wouldn't think so. Not really much to go on for a sequel, if I remember correctly.
But I mean, if you
again,
compare
it has been over 10 years, so.
But I mean, if you compare that to the most recent lineups, right? So obviously, this was the Everything Everywhere All at Once year. But you also get nominated for Best Picture, Avatar, The Way of Water, The Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, which is bonkers. it's a much weirder, more interesting lineup there. The Everything Everywhere All at Once directors win for director, but they're nominated alongside Triangle of Sadness, Tar, The Banshees of Inisherin. In fact, I would say that the only, super traditional, awards baity movie there is Steven Spielberg for The Fablemans. He gets nominated.
Yeah.
Tar itself is, it's edging closer to that more traditional thing, but it's still a bit too weird for the Academy.
There's actually a lot related. It's got a lot related in tone to Take Shelter. It's got that feeling that something's off, something's wrong. There's something beyond what we're seeing that's at play here.
Well, something that immediately came to mind during one of the scenes in Take Shelter to bring the conversation back to the movie is there's a scene where they're having breakfast and they see on the news of a train coming off the lines and creating a toxic spill.
Mm.
And that immediately made me think, white noise?
Yeah.
Anyone? And, that's an ecological disaster. The fact that the rain has the consistency of oil brings to mind the toxic spills. Man-made disasters. And you couple that with the birds dying, the animals going crazy, people going crazy. You know, this is also post-Katrina.
Yeah.
And all of the stuff that happened after that, all of the responses to the damage that the storm caused, all of the social harms that are still happening to this day in the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina, the big one, the big storm is coming. That was a pretty big terror as well, culturally speaking, in certain areas. I don't know if that particular space in Middle America was terrified of a hurricane, but they sure should have tornadoes. And I just want to talk a bit about the ending.
Yeah.
We get to see that he was right.
Well, yes. I think that's all.
You've kept being sort of pretty solidly that he was right, but the filmmakers aren't as clear-cut about that specific point.
Yeah.
Are you sure? I see the storm. I see people other than himself see the storm.
But we don't know if this is a dream or not.
I'm with Jean on this.
We never get anything
more
solid.
It's much more opaque than that, I think.
Okay,
but I also think it's beside the point. I think the point that it's making is that these things that he's worried about, this doom that's approaching, climate change, financial problems, whatever, asteroid coming out of the sky, these are beyond his control. Perhaps they will happen, perhaps they won't. What matters is that when it does happen, he's with his family and he's working. Yep. His wife is there with him. They're working together. And that's the thing that strikes me the most. That's when she sees it too. The last line of the movie is her saying, okay, and she's with him now. They're going to respond to this together as a unit. He's so much calmer now he sees it actually happening, which is interesting.
Yeah. And it's a terrifying sight too.
Yes.
The water has pulled away. That shit is charged in its own right. Seeing water pull away as a storm is approaching.
Yeah, indicating
a tsunami.
Yeah, you see in the very last shot, you can see the tsunami rising reflected on the windows.
Mm. And then there's the several tornadoes that are in the distance, the enormity of the storm itself. And something about that shot just really got to me. More so than any kind of mass destruction in any other movie kind of does, which is why I brought up at the beginning of the episode in a very clumsy roundabout way, The Knowing.
Mm.
That is a movie about a guy who, about prediction, about oncoming apocalypse, about the end of the world, but it's a lot more blunt. I enjoy the movie, but it's a lot more blunt.
Yeah.
This is a much more measured approach in terms of tonality, in terms of performance for the most part, but also it doesn't show us the destruction. The only destruction we end up actually seeing is a couple branches blown off a tree in the storm that they actually hide down in the shelter for. They get through that storm all right, even though he is terrified to leave the shelter. But that's the thing. A storm passes, But there's going to be another.
Well,
there's always another.
Well,
we had a financial crisis. There will be another. There has been a housing crisis since. There have been great deals of economic stress that have occurred. There was a pandemic. There's floods, storms, droughts, all of this shit. There's always another storm.
Well,
that is part of what the ending says to me.
Let's run the exercise too. If this is, as you believe, Harley, to be taken on the face of it, that this is a thing that is now happening, and it was a premonition. What then is the cause of this premonition? What are we meant to intuit from the fact that he saw this coming, and that he saw it coming in such detail and specificity? Because there's definitely a religious overtone that you could draw to that, the idea of it being the message for Noah to get his shit together and start building that boat.
Yeah, but at this point, how is Noah going to be able to afford that? Is he going to finance his house?
Exactly. I do love that that idea of it, like Noah taking out a mortgage so that he could build the ark.
Well, think about it. In the original story of Noah's Ark, he was just a guy, right?
Yeah.
Big-ass family who could all pitch in. But he was just a guy, right? All he had to focus on was the boat, the ship. What does Curtis have going on? Coming out of a financial crisis, living in middle America, daughter has acquired deafness, and they have all the bills associated with that. He is seeking psychiatric treatment, can't find psychiatric treatment, goes to a counselor, goes on a mild-ass sedative that seems to do nothing at all, and not only that, he still has to work, you know, perhaps like 5 days a week, doing construction, which is in itself time-consuming. He has other people that he has to manage, and just think about it. If he has been sent this message, if he is the Noah here, best he can do is a hole in the ground. He sure shit can't find the time to build a big-ass boat.
But also then, what is the purpose of the message being sent if it affects nothing in the end? He's still on that beach. He's still there seeing it approach. He warned no one. No one believed him. You know, there, I find it a... If I drill down into it on the surface level reading, I find it to be very unsatisfying as a thematic
thing. I think the ending is...
Yeah, it's why I enjoy Jean's reading more.
Well,
I think it's more metaphorical than it is literal. It is showing that whatever storm is coming, which they know is coming, that they all know is coming, they will face it together.
Yeah, I understand
that. It's more metaphorical.
And it's one of those things where I can hold both in my head. I can hold both endings and sort of, like, depending on my mood, go between each different one. And that's kind of the struggle that Curtis has throughout the movie. Like, he knows that something's wrong. He thinks he might be sick, but he also has this deep abiding feeling that something terrible is coming.
So what you're saying is that your confusion about the ending was the point.
No. I'm not saying I was confused. I'm saying that they left it open enough to have multiple readings.
I don't think there is an intended answer. Well, I don't think that there is an answer, full stop. Like, I think it's something that is designed to provoke these kinds of conversations.
Well, like, it is... The movie is pretty subjective at times. Like, the scene where he's at work, right? And he has that moment where he sort of loses it, and you don't know what he sees. And that's a very interesting element, too.
I've got... There's a quote...
It's perspective-driven until it's not.
There's a quote here from Nichols about the ending. I had a very strict idea of what the end of Take Shelter was. I know exactly what happens, and it's fascinating to see people respond to it in their own ways. The beautiful part of storytelling is that you're not just telling people a story, they're also telling you something about themselves, too, through their reactions. In that situation, you're in a conversation with your audience. I really can't think of a more rewarding or fulfilling result for something you've written. It's active, kinetic, and really humbling.
Mm.
That seems as good a place to end it as any. Is there anything else that you two would like to add?
I just want to give major props to the composer, because I think the composer did such a good job, David Wingo, and particularly those final tracks, Storm Shelter and At the Beach, they had a very interesting vibe to them. And it kind of, the fact that that last track is called At the Beach reminds me of the film On the Beach and how it's about the fear of the future and the fear of what's coming. And I think that's an interesting connection between the two works.
And I also love the scene where they're in the shelter and he's begging her to open the door, but he also is afraid of the door opening. It's great, great acting there.
Well, why don't we move on now to discuss which Muppet would play which character in The Muppet Takes Shelter. Or The Muppets Take Shelter, I suppose you could just make that a full sentence.
Yeah, and also a funny gag.
Yeah. Obviously, it's got to be Kermit as the Michael Shannon character.
Yes.
Yes.
It then obviously needs to be Miss Piggy as Jessica Chastain. Fozzie Bear can be the guy. No, I think Gonzo works better as the guy that works with him at the construction.
Fozzie is the boss.
Yeah, Fozzie can be the boss. Like, Gonzo just seems like the kind of guy who'd, like, stick the knife in, like that guy does.
Yeah.
Bunsen, obviously, for the woman that he goes... The doctor.
Yeah.
Actually, no. I take it back. Bunsen for the woman that he goes to talk to, the counselor. And then
Beaker
Sam,
for the other one.
No, Sam the Eagle for the doctor. And then Beaker as the guy that replaces the woman when she goes off to do something else.
He is no help.
And he's just talking gibberish and Kermit just turns around and leaves.
And obviously, you can paste some of the other Muppets in other different scenes. Obviously, the Swedish chef is at the cookout.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of shots of him responding to things.
Oh, what about the dude who he buys the gas masks from? Who's a funny one for that particular... Which
Uncle
Muppet
Deadly.
Do you think would sell
Uncle
army
Deadly
surplus?
Seems like, Uncle Deadly seems like the kind of guy who would have
Eagle.
A military surplus store.
Oh, yeah, fair point. Oh, who's the little one who has the TNT all the time?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, the little pyrokinetic dude.
And I'm thinking Animal is the brother. Because we don't really put Animal into these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have.
Not... Okay, Rolf is the older brother then.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
Animal is the storm. Animal's the thing that's on its
no,
way.
No, Animal is just the guy that gets touched by the black rain and starts attacking him randomly in his dreams.
Yeah.
All right, now why don't we move on to say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favorite scene or sequence is, and of course, who we would recast with this podcast's patron saint, character actor John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there?
I will start us off and I will say that my MVP for this movie has got to be Michael Shannon. He is the backbone of it. He is the spine. He is giving a really strong performance and it's his magnetism, his screen presence that makes it work as well as it does. It keeps it going because I do find myself operating at a remove from this movie for a lot of it. I think that there's something kind of bloodless about the film. In terms of its reluctance to really connect emotionally, or at least that's what I found. So it really is Shannon that keeps things going. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, it has got to be the ending. I mean, it is this really powerful moment. The score is great. The performances are excellent. It's such a striking moment to end on, and I really enjoy unpacking the potential meaning of it. I think that the movie probably wouldn't be as well remembered if it had not ended in the way that it does. In terms of who I would recast with this podcast, patron saint character actor John Lithgow, it's got to be the role of Curtis. It's got to be the Michael Shannon role. I always love an opportunity to cast John Lithgow as a lead, as the guy at the top of the call sheet, and this is a spot where he would really fit. He would fit that kind of, you know, the sort of restrained vulnerability that Curtis has going on, the anxiety, the complexity with which that role has to be played. I think that Lithgow would do that very well. So I'm going to go with that as the recasting for him.
Yep. So for me, I'm going to have to say Michael Shannon as my MVP here. He's the spine, like Lawson said. He is the bones the rest is built on. While Chastain is great and their chemistry is good, I don't think it would work with a more outwardly expressive actor. I think Michael Shannon has a particular talent to withholding emotion, withholding information from the audience, so we go looking for it. And that's a pretty difficult line to tread, and it doesn't always work with Michael Shannon. Some of his other roles can be a little inscrutable, but this is one where it really, really works, because he's found that line between vulnerability and the armor that he's put up over the course of his life to basically live in the world in which he lives. And he's desperately afraid, but he also really believes in what he's doing to help combat the storm. And I don't know, there's just a lot of complex work that he's putting in. And I think he's really, really great every time he's on screen, particularly the scenes where he's having the nightmares and waking up from them. In particular, the scene where all of the furniture is coming up and floating and he's struggling there. The look in his face and the sounds he's making, that's terror. Not fear, terror. Then I have to talk about my favorite scene or sequence, which would have to be... No, I'm going to say it. It's the scene where they're talking about leaving the shelter. And his wife, Jessica Chastain's character, is saying, I can't open that door. You have to. And that's what it means to stay with us. That's what it means to stay close to your family. That you open that door and see for yourself. And that's really, really well done. I love the staging of it. I love all the acting in it. I think both performers are doing a hell of a lot. The lighting also really helps. The fact that the lighting is so sparse, you're just focusing on them. And that's when a lot of the tangibility of the movie really comes to its own, I think. So that's my favorite scene or sequence. Who I'd recast with John Lithgow? It's Curtis. Not only does he have the most prominent male role in the piece, I think that Lithgow can do it. Obviously, he has a different style of acting than Michael Shannon does, so we would end up with a fairly different performance, but I feel that John Lithgow can add his own energy to it, his own spin to it, because he's a very well-accomplished dramatic actor. He does have talent at withholding from the audience, and he's really the only character I can kind of think of to put in that role, if I'm going to be completely honest.
Yeah, so I give my MVP to Michael Shannon. Again, it's the restraint he shows, and then when he explodes in an emotional way, you are seeing the shrapnel come off of him, and it's just a fantastic performance, I have to say. For my favorite scene or sequence, it's all of the stuff when they're actually in the shelter, and the panic, the sound design, the music for those sequences, and the fact that even when it has happened, he still can't be calm. He is still panicking. I think all of that's very well handled, and it's a fantastic piece of acting from all of the actors in that sequence. For who I would get John Lithgow to play, it's the role of Curtis. It would be a very different performance than what Michael Shannon has done, but I think that's what's interesting about this character specifically, that you could see a bunch of different takes on it working. And that's a credit to not just Michael Shannon, but to the writer and director who have made this quite interesting character. So, John Lithgow is Curtis.
Yep, so now we're going to put it to a vote. Whether or not we're a pro Take Shelter podcast or not, Lawson, why don't you cast your vote first?
I'm voting no. I don't think it reaches that level. I appreciate what it's doing. I think it's got a lot going on under the hood. It's very well made. It's very well acted. I just have a real hard time connecting with it in the way that I need to connect with it to vote pro on this. The sort of clinical approach that it can sometimes feel like it's taking does have a big impact on me and my ability to really hold it close. And for that reason, I've got to say no. It's a movie that I appreciate, but it's not a movie that I am going to return to again and again.
I will agree with Lawson on this one. It's not a pro vote for me. I do really enjoy it, but I don't love it. You know what I mean? It doesn't quite get there for me. I appreciate pretty much everything the movie's doing, but for a pro vote, I'm meant to be a little more enthusiastic. And I'm just not at that level I should be at, you know? It doesn't stand with some of the other stuff that we've put on that particular line. So
It's very far from a no, don't get me wrong. But it rests very comfortably in the upper crust of the ambivalent.
Look, I see where you guys are coming from, and its coldness, I can understand, would leave people a little cold to it. I love a lot of what this movie is doing, but I agree. It's not exactly at where it needs to be alongside the other works that we have spoken about.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We are not a pro Take Shelter podcast. Aww. So if you would like to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find us at Exit Through the Candy Can for John and myself on the Bright Side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. What do you think about Take Shelter? What do you think about the idea of pre-apocalyptic fiction in general? What are some examples of it that you can find in the media that you consume? And, yeah, what are your readings of the movie? Where do you land on the climate to financial crisis sort of dichotomy that the movie's got going on? Or do you find it to be more about looming crises in general? Yep, so you can send all of that to the Twitter. You can also like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe on the podcast app of choice. Keep in mind that when you comment on certain podcast apps, it is for the show on the whole, and on others it is for specific episodes. If you are commenting on a service like Apple Podcasts that comments on the show on the whole, let us know what episode you're referring to, cite the source, and we'll get back to you on any answering any questions or addressing any stuff that comes up. Just let us know what you're talking about. It just helps us figure this kind of thing out. But please do like, rate, comment, share, and subscribe.
It's your boy Truth.D782. Hello. Death has reared himself a throne in a strange city lying alone far down within the dim west, where the good and the bad and the worst and the best have gone to their eternal rest. The machines have cities in the sea, a sort of non-Randian rapture. But, as is the nature of the sea, space and other areas of immense space, many of them have gone crazy, styling themselves kings and queens and demons down under the sea. Undersea behemoths in the deepest depth unexplored by humanity are not so alien to the machines. Edgar Allan Poe was more prophetic than intended. In his poetry, the waves have now a redder glow, the hours are breathing faint and low, and when, amid no earthly moans, down, down that town shall settle hence, hell, rising from a thousand thrones, shall do it reverence. It's been me, your boy Truth.D782, coming at ya.
So, Lawson, we did have a little bit of discussion the other night about what we might be watching. Did you come to a conclusion on that?
I did. It did seem obvious in the end, once we'd really talked about all of the different options, there was one that fit what this podcast is more than the others, and that is Love Never Dies, the sequel to The Phantom of the Opera. It is the first pro shot that we've done. It obviously is a filming of a stage show. And if you would like to follow along at home, you can find it available for purchase or rental in Australia on the Apple, Amazon, and YouTube stores.
Yep, so join us next week for when we discuss the rare theatrical sequel, Love Never Dies. But until then, I've been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been and will continue to be Jean Lewis.
Now there's a wall between us, something that's been lost. I took too much for granted, I got my signals crossed. Just to think till it all began on a non-eventful morn. Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.